next case. You may proceed.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, my name is Mike Schabelsky, and along with Sandy Rowe, we represent the appellant, Nielsen. The county's tax assessment at issue in this case violates Virginia Code Section 58.1-3732B. The circuit court erred in upholding it. The court should reverse that judgment. Code Section 3732B prohibits a locality from imposing the beat poll tax on a company's gross receipts that are subject to income tax in other states. That statute mandates that, quote, any receipts attributable to business conducted in another state in which the taxpayer is liable for income tax shall be deducted from taxable gross receipts. That prohibition is plain and unambiguous. All gross receipts subject to income tax outside of Virginia must be excluded from the taxable measure. That prohibition was enacted by the General Assembly as part of its reform of the beat poll tax in 1996, reforms which were undertaken to lessen the burden of the beat poll tax and to curb the overreach of localities who at the time were trying to tax all companies' gross receipts. One of those key reforms reflected in 3732B was to avoid double taxation of the same gross receipts. The county agreed below, before the circuit court, that the purpose of 3732B is to avoid double taxation. That appears in the transcript, Joint Appendix 158. Yet despite that acknowledgement and acceptance by the county, its assessment here includes in the taxable measure $7 million of Nielsen's gross receipts that are subject to income tax in other states. That fact is undisputed. It is undisputed that the assessment includes $7 million of Nielsen's gross receipts attributable to business in other taxing states. The party stipulated to those facts in the calculations, which appear on page 18 of the Joint Appendix, and the calculations are repeated on page 7 of our opening brief. That fact is absolutely fatal to the county's position, and to this date, the county has never been able to lay its finger on any provision of the code that allows it to include those $7 million of receipts in the taxable measure. The state tax commissioner understood what was wrong with the county's assessment, that it violates Section 3732B. He set aside that assessment, and his decision is entitled to deference. The state tax commissioner, obviously, is the official charge with responsibility for enforcement and interpretation of the state's tax laws. And as this court has held on numerous occasions, his interpretations of those laws are entitled to great weight. That is especially the case in the context of the beat poll tax, because as part of its reforms in 1996, the General Assembly gave the state tax commissioner special responsibility for setting statewide policy for that tax. The General Assembly wanted uniform application of these reforms throughout the state, and it couldn't trust localities to administer them fairly and uniformly. In addition, and perhaps more importantly, the state tax commissioner was applying the plain language of 3732B. He applied his regulations that are consistent with that statute, and his reasoning is reasonable, logical, and ultimately unassailable. What it requires is that the localities must use consistent accounting in determining the taxable measure under the beat poll tax. In particular, if in step one of the calculation, a taxpayer must use payroll apportionment to figure out how much gross receipts to situs to Virginia, then you must use the same accounting principle to figure out how much of those receipts are attributable to business in other states.
Where do you get that in B2? Where do you find that? I see the language specifically in 3703.1A3B specifically authorizes apportionment. Where in 3732B is there any authorization for apportionment?
Yes, 3732B mandates that any receipts that you've brought in through step one that are subject to tax in other states must be pushed out. That statute doesn't mention any particular accounting method. It doesn't mention, for example, Your Honor, the direct citing principle that the circuit court said should be followed. Because what it requires is whatever methodology you use in step one, if you're bringing in taxable receipts, you have to use that same methodology to push them out. And here the math...
Let me ask you this. If the General Assembly meant that, why didn't they say that?
They did say that, Your Honor, by saying any receipts you bring in through step one that are taxable, you must push out. And here there is no dispute that $7 million of the amounts the county is trying to assess are in fact subject to a taxation in other states. So in the context of this case in particular, Your Honor, there's absolutely no dispute that by not using payroll apportionment in the second part of the calculation, by not using consistent accounting, you are taxing $7 million of receipts that the General Assembly plainly and expressly said cannot be taxed.
Well, Counsel, let me ask this question, and maybe it's too simplistic for me anyway, but when you apply the payroll proportionality for the first part to get the $24 million that in gross receipts that are assigned to Virginia, even though that was not what their gross receipts were, that already means that you have excluded from the $24 million a certain amount for all the other states, whether taxable or not. Isn't that right?
That's correct. The payroll apportionment factor in step one is applied uniformly across the nationwide receipts.
So if you take a given state like California, you've already, in doing that, you've already excluded $37 million in gross receipts under the formula from the $24 million that you... So if you've excluded that much already, how do you show that you need to exclude more?
Right. Because the statute, Your Honor, says that any receipts attributable to business in other taxable states must be excluded. So when you apply the payroll apportionment factor here of 23% to California's receipts, you are bringing in step one, 23% of the revenues attributable to business in California into the taxable measure in step one. And so if, say, there was $100 million in California, by applying the 23%, you are bringing in step one, $23 million worth of revenues attributable to business in California. You have to push out that entire $23 million in the second step in order to enforce and apply the statutory mandate that any receipts from California be omitted. So by uniformly applying the payroll apportionment factor nationwide in step one, you are necessarily bringing in, as was done here, 23% of the revenues in the taxable states.
But did you apply the 23% to the $37 million that was pushed out? Or to the $9 million, $8.5 million that were the actual receipts? It seems like you're doing it to the actual receipts.
The amount you push out is a gross dollar figure. So you look and say, okay, by applying 23% to California for step one, we brought in $8 million or whatever the number was. We have to push out that same $8 million. As the tax commissioner explained in his various decisions, you can do, the math is transitive. You can either push out all of California's receipts 100% in step one and then apply the payroll apportionment factor to just the non-taxing states, or you can apply the payroll apportionment factor to nationwide, both taxing and non-taxing states, and then apply the same portion for figure back to the taxing states in step two, because the math is transitive however it's done. But the point is the math has to be done, and you have to push out all taxable receipts or receipts attributable to taxing states. Here is no dispute that what the county has done, it has left in $7 million of taxable receipts that are subject to tax in other states, in which the General Assembly says cannot be taxed. Now, the circuit court's reasons for not deferring to the state tax commissioner's ruling and setting aside this decision are erroneous. It first concluded that Section 3732B doesn't specifically mention payroll apportionment, Your Honor's point. But as I hope I answered your question, that really misses the point, because the statute says whatever you've done in Step 1 to bring in taxable receipts, you have to push them out. And as a state tax commissioner explained in the exercise of his knowledge about tax law and formulary accounting, that you have to use the same consistent accounting to make sure you push out that full amount. The circuit court also believed the state tax commissioner's ruling in this case was inconsistent with his prior rulings in other tax cases, and with respect, the circuit court just misunderstood those rulings. Even the county conceded below that the rulings were consistent, and in fact, as he explained several times to the circuit court, their beef was not so much with his ruling in our particular case, but rulings it had made in prior cases that they were seeking to appeal. And then third, Your Honor, the circuit court believed that the methodology by the state tax commissioner was irrational and only provided an estimate. Again, the circuit court was in error, because the state tax commissioner's determination is not an estimate of the amount of taxable receipts that have been brought in. It is a precise calculation to the dollar of the exact amount that has been brought in. And it is rather the circuit court and the county's methodology that is irrational, because they are trying to put the taxpayers in an impossible catch-22 position. They would like to say, for step one, the taxpayer must use payroll apportionment to bring in all these gross receipts, because it's impossible to use general citizen principles. Aha, but on step two, taxpayer don't get the benefit of pushing out the taxable receipts from other states, because we're not going to let you use payroll apportionment. You have to use general citizen rules, which by definition, you are impossible or impractical to use. The state tax commissioner realized that can't have been the intent of the General Assembly, because that would be irrational and arbitrary. And then finally, Your Honors, the circuit court concluded that Nielsen did not prove the amount of effort that the Arlington office had contributed to those out-of-state taxable receipts. Well, that really isn't a relevant determination under the statute, because the statute requires the exclusion of all taxable receipts that are subject to tax in other states, irrespective of the Virginia locality's level of effort at earning them. They participate at all in earning them, as was stipulated is the case here. It doesn't matter whether it took them 1 hour or 1,000 hours to earn that time. But also, Your Honor, Nielsen had no obligation or burden to prove anything. Nielsen prevailed before the state tax commissioner. It was the county appeal, and that under the Virginia Code, the county had the burden to prove that the state tax commissioner had overstated the amount of the allowable deduction. The county proved nothing. It rested on the party stipulations, and the circuit court was in error in saying that Nielsen had to prove the $7 million was justified. Thank you, Your Honor. I'll reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
2 minutes and 20 seconds.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Raymond A. Warren, Ray Warren. I am a Deputy Commissioner of Revenue for the County of Arlington. I am also the legal counsel to the Commissioner of Revenue, Ingrid H. Maroy, and I represent her in this matter. The statute 58.13732B2 says from receipts otherwise taxable, there will be a deduction. As the justice indicated, that means that the receipts had to have been taxable by Virginia in the first place. Receipts that are removed from Virginia taxation in step one are not taxable by Virginia. As for consistent accounting, in fact, the appellant did not use a consistent accounting here. The state tax commissioner's actual ruling would require simply using the formula against gross receipts, against payroll, using the payroll formula again a second time. The tax commissioner assumed that the company would not be able to say how much business we conducted in other states. In fact, they were able to say that. They were able to say in the state of Ohio, where they had no payroll whatsoever, that they conducted business, and they were given a credit for that. There is not a long history of this particular formula, non-statutory formula, being in effect. BPOL reform took place, as counsel indicated, in 1996. In 2000, the department published BPOL guidelines. These were later incorporated into the Virginia Administrative Code. There's a whole section of regulations. None of them contain this formula. In fact, even though the commissioner is given the right to enact regulations, this is not a regulation. This is simply a decree and a decision. This particular new formula was not first articulated until 2010 and not finally articulated until 2012 and has continued to be modified through this year.
Is there statutory authority, or is it just basically it's more logical if we're going to use the apportionment for the first calculation, we use the apportionment for the second calculation?
There isn't logic to it, Your Honor, because the assumption is that where you have payroll is where you also do business.
Right.
For example, if a company provided winter snow removal services, but for reasons of employment markets felt that their fulfillment center should be in a southern state, such as Alabama, their customers would not actually be where the most of their payroll would be. So the formula is in no way related to the actual amount of business that may or may not be conducted in a state.
So your argument is that they have to have the actual receipts following the statute. You said they have to have any receipts attributable to business conducted in another state.
Well, they were actually able to determine to the dollar how much business they did in each state. And their determination actually varied quite a bit from what the tax commissioner's formula would be. So they are actually able to do that part. There are two things they have to do. They have to say, how much business do we conduct in a state that taxed us, like Ohio or California? The second thing they need to do is to say, well, how much of these were otherwise taxable or assigned to Virginia in the first place?
Right.
This is the difficulty that they're having. I would point out to the court, and I also need to make this point, I have promised Mr. Tramblian more than half the time, so I will be ending my presentation shortly.
So, counsel, why do they use the formula in the first step?
Why do they use the formula?
Because
the legislature specifically authorized the use of a formula.
And they authorize it. What's the reason for the authorization from the legislature?
Because it was felt in some cases it was impossible or impractical to determine where you earned the gross receipts.
So if it's impossible to determine where you earn it, isn't it impossible to determine how you deduct it or where you deduct it?
It may or may not be, Your Honor. In some cases, first of all, as is indicated by their own case, remember, they're not asking to impose the tax commissioner formula. They're asking to do yet a third version of it. As they've indicated, they could tell us exactly how much business they conducted in each state. So it's not impossible. What is difficult sometimes is to say, well, how much of this is because of the efforts of the Virginia office? How much of this was what was assigned to Virginia in the first place? It may be difficult. It's not always impossible. Some companies have territories. Some companies say, in this particular state, we know Virginia personnel would have worked on it only. Even though we can't tell in the global amount how much Virginia contributed to our grocery receipts, we can tell you that the Virginia office does this or the California office does that. A lot of federal contractors keep that kind of time.
You're trying to keep your time, but I do have a question about the way the Commissioner of Revenue did this. And I understand that if a state actually collected more gross receipts than it was assigned in the application of the formula, then the commissioner felt that you could deduct some more. Okay, but the statute says any receipt subject to tax. Why did you apply the payroll percentage to what, in fact, would have been the difference? In other words, the whole, if you had $10 million in actual and $9 million through the payroll, the extra $1 million, you then applied the payroll again. But the statute says any receipts. Isn't that other $1 million an actual receipt that they could have? Could have been subject to tax on?
Well, again, Your Honor, that's why we probably shouldn't have applied any amount to it. You've got to understand
any formula to it? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, okay. Your Honor, I apologize. We are not, as assessors, in a position to defy the tax commissioner. And at the point we made the assessment after the opinion denoted as 10-229, we had been ordered to use the percentage. We read that as best we could in conjunction with the other language in all of the tax commissioner's opinions saying The receipts are deductible to the extent they were assigned to Virginia in the first place. We reasoned that receipts that were already excluded in step one could not have been assigned to Virginia. We did not voluntarily say we should use 23%. We were in a position where we had no choice but to try to comply with the tax commissioner. At that point, nothing was under appeal. We only made the prudential decision to appeal after it became apparent that it was a much bigger change was going to take place in the way the taxes had been administered. And I would point out to the court, the taxes had been administered this same way from 1996 until 2010. If this was indeed the way the legislature should have intended it, this actually would have arisen before then, and it would be no need for the tax commissioner to make a new rule, which he admits and says is a new rule at this point. Your Honor, I would like to defer to my co-counsel if there's nothing else.
May it please the Court, I'm R.I. Trambley, and I'm counsel for the County Board of Arlington County, Virginia. I want to make two arguments and address two things that Mr. Shabaleski said in his opening. The issue before the Court today is the tax commissioner's opinion, and it was improper for two reasons, two primary reasons. First, that the tax commissioner's ruling was contrary to the unambiguous intent of the General Assembly, and two, the tax commissioner's ruling compels rote use of a methodology that is at odds with this court's requirement that deductions be strictly construed against the taxpayer. First, the formula that the tax commissioner has stated must be used contravenes the legislative intent. This case is on all fours with this court's ruling in Commonwealth Department of Taxation versus Champion International, a case which I note Nielsen never addresses in its briefs. In Champion, as in this case, the Commonwealth adopted a tax policy that was flatly at odds with the legislative intent to admit a distinction. In that case, the Department of Taxation recognized a distinction between business and non-business income, despite the fact that the legislative intent was that there was not to be a distinction recognized. Champion held that the Commonwealth's policy violated legislative purpose and was an invalid and impermissible encroachment on the legislative branch. Similarly, in this case, while the General Assembly exercised its prerogative in 3703.1 in creating a method of citing gross receipts by payroll, it notably did not do so for calculation of 3732 deductions. The key point is the relevant language in the apportionment statute, both of those statutes, 3703.1 and 3732, were adopted at the same time as part of the same act, as part of the same bill. The General Assembly chose to include payroll apportionment methodology in the apportionment statute, but did not so limit the deduction statute. This court has repeatedly stated, and I'm quoting from Brown versus Commonwealth, but this is said in numerous cases, when the General Assembly includes specific language in one statute, but omits the language from another statute, the courts must presume the exclusion of the language was intentional, because under these circumstances, it's evident the General Assembly knows how to include such language in the statute to achieve an intended objective. Thus, the omission of such language in another statute represents an unambiguous manifestation of a contrary intention. Just like in Champion, the tax commissioner here ruled contrary to the legislative intent and invalidly and impermissibly encroached on the legislative branch. Just like in Champion, the tax commissioner argued to this court that there were many policy reasons that justified his taking that position. And I think this court said the tax commissioner advanced ingenious arguments in sort of support of its position, including the projection of dire consequences that might result. And the court's answer was, those arguments are policy arguments that should be addressed to the General Assembly. And I don't believe this case is distinguishable from Champion, and that this court should again reject the Commonwealth's attempt to legislate in contravention of what the General Assembly has stated. Second, even if there was authority for the tax commissioner to do this, his holding violates the rule that deductions should be strictly construed. The tax commissioner's ruling automatically awards deductions without regard to whether the taxpayer's employees in Virginia contributed anything to the non-Virginia receipts, whether it's 100%, 0%, or something in between. I would submit that this violates the requirement that deductions be strictly construed against the taxpayer. Here in this case, Nielsen claims a large deduction while at the same time conceding that they have no idea whether their claimed deduction bears any relation to the reality of its business receipts. Both of Nielsen's witnesses at trial, Mr. Carr and Mr. Webb, conceded on cross-examination that they didn't know whether Nielsen's Virginia employees contributed 0%, 100%, or under the formula 23.8668% to the receipts for which they were seeking a deduction. Mr. Carr conceded that the deduction calculated by the tax commissioner's formula would be the same, would be identical, whether one Virginia employee contributed 1 hour to the work or whether 500 Virginia employees contributed 100,000 hours to the work. And I'll note that at trial, Nielsen put on no evidence that they were not able to calculate the receipts eligible for this deduction. The testimony from their accountant was they didn't do that analysis. They came to court and relied strictly on the tax commissioner's formula and, quote, didn't do that analysis. The problem with the tax commissioner's ruling is it has nothing to do with what the taxpayer actually does in its business. Under the tax commissioner's erroneous ruling, a deduction can be calculated without knowing anything about what actually occurred. The tax commissioner's formula ignores the facts and, by rote, awards large deductions regardless of the facts. As the trial court noted, and I understand why the tax commissioner did what he did. It may be a hard problem, and this is an easy solution. But as the trial court said, while this results in a predictable outcome, it fails to provide accuracy or even a semblance or scrutiny of the truth.
Well, counsel, let me ask you this before your time is up, because, as you said, this is a hard problem, and we have to resolve it. Your co-defendant here is suggesting to this court that, and you started out by saying the issue here is the legitimacy of this tax commissioner's opinion, is that we reverse that opinion, say it's wrong, and then your co-defendant sets out a number of alternatives, none of which are, in other words, affirming the trial court simply because the tax commissioner was wrong, or not setting up a new tax formula. Are you agreeing that this court should actually come up with some kind of tax formula?
No.
What result are you asking us to?
I would have to respectfully disagree with my colleague. I understand why the local commissioner would love to have all the guidance they can get on how to apply this, but what's before this court is what was in the assignments of error. The assignments of error were very crafted very narrowly, and the calculation of the assessment by the local commissioner of the revenue was not error was not assigned to that by the by Nielsen or by the Commissioner of the Revenue. So our position is that issue is not before the court. So we would simply ask that the court be affirmed below. Now, I do want to address two statements that Mr. Chevaleski said. First, he stated that the calculation under 3732 using the tax commissioner's formula was not an estimate. It's a precise calculation. Well, page 21 of the appendix, the tax commissioner says the contrary. He says, payroll apportionment is an approximation, and any deduction for out-of-state receipts would, at best, be an estimate. So it's not a precise calculation. Mr. Chevaleski also said that the issue about 1 hour versus 500 hours was irrelevant. And I would simply submit, how can the facts that support a deduction be irrelevant? They have to be strictly construed. And if the formula results in the same result regardless of the facts, that can't be strict construction. Thank you.
Mr. Chevaleski?
Thank you, Your Honors. I would like to first address Justice Powell's question. The reason payroll apportionment was used for step one was because it was agreed and stipulated by the parties that it was impossible or impractical to use the general sizing rules. Second point, there is no estimate here. There is no dispute that county's assessment includes $7 million of receipts that are taxable in other states. And in fact, we have had brief after brief from the county and their amicus, and now argument from two of their lawyers, and not once have they disagreed with that stipulated fact that at the end of the day, no matter what else you say about their approach and their assessment, they are seeking to tax $7 million. Of receipts from Nielsen attributable to business in other states. They say, well, the exclusion of that $7 million is not hinged to the amount of effort that Nielsen's Arlington office contributed. That's not required under the statute, and nor is it a factor under their own assessment. The methodology they used to deduct part of the taxable gross receipts, the $5 million instead of the full $12 million, would be the same regardless of whether Arlington's office contributed 1 hour to those out-of-state tax receipts or 1 million hours to those taxable receipts. So they're faulting the tax commissioner for not relying on some sort of evidentiary basis that the statute neither requires and that the county itself doesn't even follow. And this is not a question about strict construction construed against the taxpayer here for two reasons. First, the statute is unambiguous. It plainly requires the exclusion of any tax, any receipts taxable in other states. There's nothing to interpret for or against either party. But also, Your Honors, this provision is part of the chapter that defines what is the taxable measure that the county can use for imposing its BPOL tax. And as this court recognized in two cases under this reform statute, the English construction case and the Ford Motor case, these provisions are limits on the locality's taxing power and must be construed strictly against them. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Call the next case.